Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is.
Timothy Brennan. I'm a professor. I'm a writer. I'm a speaker. I'm an activist. And I work at the University of Minnesota, and I'm right now in Minneapolis.
A lovely city, and I'm wondering whether, like my friends in Toronto, you've not had the ice you expected this winter.
Well, not at all. Of course, it's all of the rain is falling on the east and west coasts. It's kind of culturally elitist, this rain. So there's been a drought all winter, basically. So we haven't gotten the snow and ice, but it's been, the golf courses are open in late February, early March, which
Grief.
never happens here. Luckily, we've had a little snow, but it's the same kind of horror show, I suppose, in the offing that other people are experiencing in a much worse way in other parts of. I'll say one thing though about the Twin Cities that might be kind of interesting to people. They may not know this, but there's a huge rush on the housing market here because there's a lot of people living in the southwest of the United States or in California who have expensive houses in Los Angeles who are saying, we can't put up with the weather extremes and we want to go to a place that's milder and has a lot of water, So it's really a very interesting kind of a cultural aristocracy of a sort, right? People with money, but also who are involved in the film industry, intellectuals. They're moving here in large numbers.
So the Los Angeles Lakers might move back to the place that gave them their name. Who
I think
knows?
there's very few people with your background that would know that kind of sports
But
statistic. Pretty impressive.
it's interesting, friends of mine in northern Sweden, where I do some work, are referring to themselves as the lifeboat of the future. Of course, people with a big cultural connection to the upper Midwest, because
Well,
that's
yeah.
where people will be fleeing in a century or 50 years. Who knows, right?
We make jokes about it, about, like opening up new beaches on Lake Superior where there'll be a new surfing culture, People, if you've never been to Lake Superior, you'd have to understand that it is the coldest large body of water that you can imagine. It's almost intolerable to stick your foot into it.
So, Prof, now that we've had our, the almost inevitable we laugh, but as you say, it's deadly serious climatic conversation. Are there things that might include climate change and global heating that are currently preoccupying, interesting, retarding, dynamizing you? What are the big issues for you right now?
Well, I mean, there's so many. There's intellectual questions within the university, of course, but I think the overarching thing is, of course, I mean, that organization, Extinction Rebellion, is a rather apt name that should give us all pause. That the kind of, kind of culture of eternal warfare that we see largely as a result, I think, of American imperialism is one that can only get worse and more desperate. When people are fighting wars over water. So the kind of the enormity of this particular problem is, of course, like I suppose for most of us, preoccupying. I think, I've always hated that statement that's attributed sometimes to Jameson and sometimes to Zizek about it being easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. I think it's there's something really off about it to me because what I think it's really trying to say, or what it should be saying, is that it's very clear to us that the leaders of global capitalism are ones that would much rather see the end of the world than the end of their own system, and they're willing to take us there. So I think that is one issue. Another issue, a really big one. I was asked recently by the Chronicle of Higher Education, the kind of major vehicle in the United States for university-related matters that's read by all kinds of people, not just people within the university. They said, would you write a piece on whether or not anti-colonialism is a mere metaphor, right? And I think I understood the nature of their inquiry. They were trying to say that when people protest at Harvard University or other universities against the genocidal assault that is taking place in Gaza by the Israeli military. And they support the likes of Hamas on the grounds that, Palestine has a right to defend itself. It's as though they're not really being given the right to do so in a way that would have been unthinkable back in, the time of the Algerian Independence War. Of course, the FLN would have been considered, whether you were for their politics or not, a legitimate anti-colonial organization. Yes, and they also resorted at times to terrorism. I'm not defending terrorism, mind you, not at all, but I'm just trying to say that clearly the effective and somewhat chosen, not completely chosen by the Palestinian people organization to defend themselves militarily is Hamas. So is anti-colonialism a metaphor? Is it only something that we talk about decolonializing texts or decolonializing attitudes? Or is it not the case that, as one example among others, that the Palestine question is like the litmus test for whether or not one is authentically and sincerely anti-colonial in their sentiments? It strikes me that there's a massive knowledge and citational apparatus within post-colonial studies that will cite people like, Saba Mahmood or Sarah Ahmed or Fred Moten or people like this. And I'm not against their work. I think it's very, very interesting and important work, but they'll know those kinds of figures, but they won't know, Karl Polanyi, or they won't, pay any attention to Samir Amin. So in a way it translates into this either indifference towards or maybe just ignorance about the actual countries of the world, the nation states of the world that are involved in an anti-colonial resistance to American imperialism. I'm talking about, Venezuela and Cuba and North Korea and Brazil and other places. And so it's odd to me. And you say, invigorating or depressing. It's a little bit of both. For me, this question in this field that I consider myself a part of post-colonial studies, that so few people are taking up those kinds of questions.
I guess one of the interesting things for me there is that this, well, there are two things I'd love to get your view on. One is that this is about political economy not being kosher for lots of literary critics. They might not hate it, but they're not going to read it or think about it, per Samir Amin. The other thing is that, ironically, if you think back to the national liberation struggles of the 20th century, so many of them were led by people who were great writers, people who were intellectuals in the cultural, political sense, not necessarily on the left, left, left. I think of Eric Williams, great historian. Aimé Césaire, Léopold Senghor, people with very different political positions, but they were intellectual giants. Fanon obviously is one that these folks will cite, but they're not going to cite Eric Williams on sugar and capitalism and slavery. And they're probably not going to read Senghor's poetry, at least not as far as I can see. Whilst also not necessarily embracing or getting involved in those complex struggles of liberation, where they're, sorry, this is a long-winded, only quasi question, but in other words, when the Chronicle posed that issue to you, one way of responding would be to say, not like it used to be, because metaphors were the stuff of resistance to the British, the French, the Belgians, the Portuguese in the 20th century. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I think that not just in this field of post-colonial studies, but I think intellectual life within the American university, I think, and I say American university, I think it's the Anglo-American
Right.
university system, which coming on the heels of many centuries of imperial, kind of rule, means that many of the intellectual trends, for well or ill, that are followed in other universities in France and Argentina and China, are first developed and theorized in places like the United States and England. And that's not how it should be, but it I think it is a good description of what happens. So, I mean, it seems to me that the intellectual life of the university today is subject in many ways to a kind of presentism, a kind of, it would never see itself this way, but it's subject to the notion of the new and the now, right? To sort of internalize a kind of basic capitalistic value, if I could put it that way, which has led it, among other things, to see, let's say, the protest element embedded in postcolonial studies as being the creation of the last 2 or 3 decades, where the demographics of, the American and British university have fundamentally changed, and you have many people coming from other parts of the world or descended from those who do. And so there's this, first of all, kind of spurious equation between who one is and what one thinks. There's that kind of problem. But more than anything, it's this radical kind of eviction of the legacies of anti-colonialism from that heyday of national liberation movement that you just cited. So there are many consequences here. I mean, I would say that the kind of philosophical foundation of that anti-colonial liberation movement, the heydays of the immediate post-World War II era, right up to the Sandinista Revolution of 1979, the philosophical foundations was left Hegelian Marxism. Okay. And that couldn't be a more explicit target of the current people who think of themselves as, and in some ways, it's true, they are, the kind of radical left wing of cultural theory in the university. So this is another thing that preoccupies me. I've written quite a lot about it, the kind of targeting of left Hegelian thought, the outlawing of it, the association of it with a kind of love of the state and a kind of, high humanist enlightenment racism and lots of other things that really kind of fall apart when you begin to involve yourself in intellectual history and you dig these things up. So this is this point you make about the great writers of that era is well taken. But I think there's also other reasons why there's this severing of the connection with those vital legacies from the past.
Yes. And I mean, I wanted to ask you about the Borrowed Light project. I've only read volume one. I assume later volume or volumes are out, but they're not, in my hands. But there you're looking, at least in volume one, at the way in which, and you mentioned Hegelian Marxism, but prior to that, Hegel and prior to that, Vico are crucial resources for not only understanding anti-colonial struggles, but actually incarnating avant la lettre, as it were.
Right.
And I wondered if you could tell us a bit about that, because for people of my inclination, Hegel's ideas about the necessity to transform territory in order to claim it, and the necessity to make semiotic marks in ways it can be recognized, can be taken as, and you are familiar with this argument, legitimation of colonialism and the destruction of indigenous life. So it's a great provocation to have him and Vico as, I know you don't reduce them to this, but good guys in the story. It's really invigorating and an exciting adventure that you're
Yeah,
on.
I was well aware that probably it would be something that would be not taken at face value at first as being logical or sensible or politically alluring. I knew that there would be that initial attempt to reject and deny. But the thing is, I hope I don't get lost in this, but I want to say one thing that I think that because this also preoccupies me. The fall of the Soviet Union, I think we're seeing more clearly in retrospect, was a disaster. It was a disaster in geopolitical terms, but it certainly was a disaster, I think, politically and intellectually for the left in metropolitan societies like that of Europe and the United States and elsewhere. And I think that the deep pessimism, the deep cynicism about political alternatives that finds itself across the array of the left has paralyzed it in many respects and made it form, I think, damaging habits intellectually. But one good thing that's come out of this disaster, which had a lot of consequences, people not believing in political organization any longer, people believing that the Marxist project was dead, many, many of these kinds of things, a lot of which is being turned over now. It's being effectively countered, and you can't find a greater heyday and fertility of thought on the Marxist left than today. But one of the things it did was it says, in order for us to find a way forward, we need to go back to look at intellectual resources that we overlooked or that we can see anew. So you have this tendency, of course, of returning to Spinoza in certain wings of the left and within Marx. So when I wrote Borrowed Light, I was thinking about, I was trained at Columbia University. I studied with Edward Said. I was very attuned already, politically and emotionally and in other ways towards humanism, as a project. But, that attempt to find resources in the past that actually, we're not merely a humanist counter to what the Spinozist thinkers on the left were attempting to do when they went back to that particular past. And they went back to that past in order to outmaneuver the legacies of Hegel, to find a Marxism that was not influenced by Hegel, because the philosopher that they chose as their inspiration didn't know Hegel and wrote before Hegel. So I think that move. This is one of the things that made me see the possibilities in going back to a thinker like Vico. And what I've since come to see, and unfortunately, that second volume of Borrowed Light is not finished. I'm working on it right now.
I'm
I'm working on
sorry,
it.
I asked an embarrassing and ignorant
That's
question.
okay. It would have been done, but I didn't finish it because I was asked to write this biography of Said, and so I wrote that instead. But I am finishing it now. But is that how many of the people on the Marxist left and within the anti-colonial movements knew about Vico and read Vico and saw him as being part of that same lineage that I was at pains to lay out in that book. So I think we need to get to the point where we can learn to fail again, differently and better, and just continually think about that way, as opposed to saying, okay, well, the Soviet experiment and actually existing socialism didn't work, so we have to somehow find a completely different thing, like, I don't know, we must therefore necessarily develop postmodernist, conclusions from that. I think no, you learn from and use what you can from that tradition and fight again on a new ground.
I guess one of the things in the US was that the so-called peace dividend that would come flowing to the arts, but especially health and education after the Cold War simply never came. And one of the defeats or the defects of liberalism in the United States was that it was so dependent on the Cold War. And so its collapse is partly about the fact that this state infrastructure supporting liberalism. And not only state infrastructure, but private sector infrastructure, from foundations to the New York Times, depended on the idea of an anti-Marxist, anti-Soviet, very small L left. And that got wiped away, just as did, ugly language to use, but the Soviet bloc's capacity to control medieval particularism, to use an old-fashioned term, and the explosion of all those things since. Along with the short-sightedness slash idiocy of US foreign policy, where you go to bed with India, you wake up with Pakistan, then you kick Pakistan out of the bed because you no longer need it because the Cold War is over. You try to create a Vietnam for the Soviet Union and Afghanistan. You wake up finding that, guess what, the wrong people are in power. I mean, the incredible stupidity of liberals at the
Yes.
CIA and state over decades. All those things required very little geopolitical imaginary or imagination to understand. But at least there was a set of blocks that kept things relatively stable in geopolitics. So, ironically, not from a Marxist perspective, but from a more traditional international relations one, stability has been endangered since 89 to 91, 92, and has collapsed, along with, domestic US liberalism.
Yeah, I mean, if you've ever talked to anybody who lived in Iraq, under Saddam Hussein, they didn't like Saddam Hussein, but it was a vibrant, artistically fertile, intellectually inquisitive, inventive culture. It's a kind of a secular center and masterpiece, if you will, of the Middle East state structure, along with Lebanon. I mean, so the entire redrawing of the map of the Middle East, the enormous suffering that has been created there by the United States and Israel's efforts to completely occupy and control every single aspect of it, never would have happened if the Soviet Union were still in power. And that's just part of it. If you're also approaching it from an anti-colonial point of view, you just when you look at the actual history of what happened in countries like Cuba and much of Africa when the Soviet Union fell, in terms of the support that was given and the intellectual openness that was created by those alliances, it's just astounding. So I think that there's intellectual movements that are taking place right now in the university that, to me, are also possibly linked to the change in attitude and the depression, which I said came in, the kind of post-fall of the Berlin Wall funk that everybody, was wrestling with in one way or another, that I think we need to attend to, and that I spend a lot of my time thinking about and reading and trying to criticize with my students and writing about the post critical move that comes from the science studies of Bruno Latour, for example, is a very, very influential movement that I think needs to be met head on, and an alternative needs to be provided to it. Because it's very alluring to a lot of people in the way that they think. Paradoxically, I think it's the embrace, the free, I don't it, the enormously numerically potent embrace of a certain kind of cultural Marxism within the university that has, I think, paradoxically weakened the Marxist positions as some of us understood it from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So I'm thinking of the kind of mixing of affect theory with Marxism that one finds in the work of Lauren Berlant, the late Lauren Berlant. Very influential books, very interesting arguments that are conducted there in her books, but ones that very much give voice to the feeling of hopelessness and depression and the worthlessness of being intellectually aligned with and organizationally active in movements that actually make a claim upon the state and therefore are going to be in play, as it were, politically. So these things, this particular kind of drift of affect theory, I think, but also the post-critical, and I think the turn to aesthetics, it's very interesting that the New Left Review, for example, had a long running forum on a recent book by Joseph North that talks about different traditions within literary criticism, which he in what I take to be a somewhat Britain-centric theory version of literary criticism is turning the attention to aesthetics. So Sian Nai and others are there's a general turn towards aesthetics, which is something that I think is actually very promising in many ways. But I think it's part of a retreat of a certain sort, when there's issues that people could, in the mode of a public intellectual, do more to directly face using the knowledge that we've gathered within our seminar rooms.
You mentioned both studying with and then writing a book about Edward Said. Not exactly a Marxist, but
No.
certainly somebody whose work and name are invoked in very positive ways in terms of resistance to imperialism. I wonder if you could share with us a little bit of the book you wrote and that vexed question. Well, I guess there are two that I have in mind. One is Said's relationship to Marxism, the other, his relationship to the popular.
Yeah. Okay. His non-Marxism was often a criticism of it from the left, in that he was working in an academic environment in which people called themselves Marxist when it was really like doing a Marxist reading of Jane Austen, that old joke. And so he was saying that on the one hand, he was much more interested in a form of activism that would bring the kind of unthreatening generalist knowledge of the humanist, right, out into the public, who could be trusted because precisely they were not some, wonk from a policy institute, and because they did not have any skin in the game, and they had
Right.
nothing to gain. They were just sort of generalists, and they could therefore draw connections that specialists could not, right? And this would undercut kind of wholesale punditry upon which the talking heads news programs, often relied. And so, yes, he was very, very geared always to, bringing his ideas and his politics and the sheer beauty of literature and the glories of humanism and the knowledge and freewheeling curiosity that comes only from an intellectual, into that public sphere. And he benefited from being at Columbia University in the media capital of the United States, and all of his mentors when he first arrived at Columbia were people who were not just writing academic books, but were publishing in the crossover publications like Partisan Review. And so he learned how to do it in one way, right? Attending all the parties where people from, The Nation and Condé Nast publications were, drinking martinis with them. So he learned how to do that, right? But he's not a Marxist because he's also saying that it's not indigenous to the Middle East. It's absolutely impossible in the PLO of those days. He wasn't in the PLO, but he was affiliated with it. Certainly defended it, supported it. It was not possible to be in the PLO in those days and not, have Marxists on your left and on your right. They were all around you. They were part of the political fabric of the Middle East. But he felt that it didn't really offer a solution that was applicable indigenously to the area. So this was another reason why he created space between him and that. However, all that being said, intellectually, it has to be remembered that his own leads, as it were, right, the traditions, the legacies that he followed were all left-hegelian Marxists,
Like
right? The
Lukács
people
was a big influence,
like
right?
Lukács, Antonio Gramsci. These were the two people that he cared the most about. And then, of course, Theodor Adorno, not an activist, but nevertheless somebody that he borrowed from a great deal in the latter portion of his career, is a left-hegelian and a Marxist scholar. So, I mean, these were the people, and then many of the people that he dedicated his books to and that influenced him the most when he was growing up were Marxists and communists who were often, martyred for their beliefs. These are the people that he took his leads from and patterned himself after. So it's a complicated story. He's also very liberal in his politics. I don't want to oversell the idea of his influence for Marx and of Marxism, but his framework was very much a combination of that and other things. So, yeah, I mean, there's much more to say. I could talk a lot about his work, but he's somebody who always bristled at the severing of the heydays of post-colonial liberation movements of the past. He was, in many ways, in the book Orientalism, trying in a very unpropitious era, right, the very beginning of the Reagan-Thatcher counter-reformation, right, to keep alive that sensibility that was present in the early 70s and 60s of solidarity within the metropolis towards the anti-colonial liberation movements. And by that, we mean armed movements. We mean movements that were fighting on the ground for to establish a state. I mean, after all, that is the very pattern and model that the Palestinians themselves were involved in at the time.
And I wanted to ask you something that's off to one side, but perhaps of interest. What was it like writing a book for a trade press?
That's an interesting question. It was very, very different, as you can imagine. It is, first of all, the case that you don't sell a book to those trade presses. You sell a prospectus, you sell an idea, right? And so, I sat down and somehow, because I've known Edward for so long and I'd been writing a lot, I'd written 13 essays about his work by that point. So I had an idea about what I wanted to say. But I also wanted this to be a different kind of book. I mean, I don't, it's not my take on him. Like that wouldn't do. This has got to be more universal. This has got to depend on lots of other people too. So I knew I'd have to be interviewing lots of people that were going to show me sides to him I never knew. I'm going to have to go acquaint myself with Cairo and Beirut and lots of other things. Anyway, I wrote this proposal. And I thought that it was going to be fairly straightforward. And I wrote the book in a year and a half or something like that, and handed it in. And my editor, who is terrific, Eileen Smith at Farrar, Straus & Giroux, was very harsh, very hard on it. But it's funny. You think like for a press like that, they're going to have these people who go through and like. Line edit. They're going to give you word choices and give you suggestions about this, that. Not at all. Not at all. What you'd get is a long line in the margin saying, you're getting lost in the weeds, or, okay, I think we cut the chapter here. I think everything after here is fill. So you don't really get so much detailed direction as you get very, very untactful expressions of opinion about what's working and what isn't. So we went back and forth about two or three times, I would say, over some years, a couple years. And finally I understood. I understood, how not to go on and on, how to convey with a kind of gesture of the hand, to use ellipsis, to be more paratactical than I'm used to being. We're dealing with difficult ideas. We're dealing with linguistic theories and not only that, all the subtleties byroads of Palestinian politics. And so there's lots of things to explain, things that people like you and I would really want to get into, really in the depths of and to theorize. And you have to figure out ways to say things that go by much more quickly in a different kind of language. So I love the experience. I learned how to write differently. And people who have read my stuff before said, you've written differently. It's not the same kind of prose. And I'm just so happy to have gone through the experience. And I just learned a ton from it.
Is it changing the way you're writing now when you're producing more materials for more conventionally scholarly outputs?
Well, yeah,
Outlets?
it is, it is. Like people like us, I think, we're always writing various things, and we've got like shelves filled with essays half formed, with things that once were, lectures given and that maybe could be turned into an essay. So it is the case that over the last year and a half or so, I've written four or five essays, and I've used material that I'd written before I wrote the say biography. So in front of my older prose. So I did in fact use some of it, and I changed a lot of it. And more than anything though, more than anything, here's the thing. I have to finish, because I'm committed to finishing, the second volume of Borrowed Light, which necessarily, given the first, is pitched to a certain kind of audience and needs to be completed in a certain kind of way. But I think that after I finish that book, I'm going to write for trade presses from now on. And I'm going to try to write the book that a general public would want to read.
And of course, Said himself wrote for trade presses, and whilst he was theoretically inclined, he was really quite an elegant writer. He was a very successful music critic for the nation, just like Arthur Danto was a very good art critic for the nation. And apart from being a terrific English language stylist, he was sort of a plain speaker, no?
I think that if you only read him and not, heard him speak, I think that you don't really get him completely. And you read the essays that he wrote very differently after you've seen him speak, I think. Thankfully, we live in the world of YouTube, and that even young kids who are hearing about him for the first time can go and see him speak and get a sense of his personality. He's always he not only was brilliantly conversational in his engagements with people, and the orality and performative aspects of his speaking come through, I think, even in his writing. But I think that he wrote and theorized actually about the aesthetics of a language that one creates that mirrors the immediacy of speech. He was very, very self-conscious about this. He crafted this. Now, that being said, I don't want to be I don't want to come off as a groupie or somebody who's like overly adulatory of this guy. But I mean, he did always strike me as having a certain kind of a genius for doing that quickly. He wrote things quickly, some of these essays that have stood the test of time, they're written in like a week. And I don't know how that is with you, but that's a very short time span to write an essay of this sort that, the sort that I'm thinking of that he wrote. So yeah, I think that he is somebody who, despite I believe he needed to. You talked about political economy before. That's a huge weakness in his writing. He, tried to write a book about culture and imperialism, and he didn't have any political economy in it. And I think that that was a serious failing on his part. I think that he needed to have read Hegel and some of the philosophers that he did not read. It would have sharpened his writing and thinking a great deal. So there's many things I would have problems with. But the thing about him is that he was able to, I think he's the one who invented really the critique of Islamophobia. I think that that book, Uncovering Islam, is a pioneering book in that one respect. It's not even the book that many people think of when they think of his work, but he did that sort of thing. He gave us political tools. The way that he analyzed the discourse on terrorism, it's priceless. It's just, when you read it, just it hits every kind of point. Recently, a friend of mine had an article about Said in The Guardian in England, and he was wondering about something that I might know of that Edward had written that would be relevant to the current siege of Gaza. And he has this thing that he wrote in 1989, which is an open letter to American Jews about, how can they tolerate what's happening in their name, right? He never published it, but it had recently been, put online by some of his former associates. And so it's so alive. It's so contemporary. What he was writing in 1989, he saw so clearly what people now, given this terrible war, are beginning to see for the first time clearly. It's really quite a feat that he was so prescient.
Now, you've mentioned 1989, and we have, and what was circling around it. I want to take you back, as they say in baseball commentary. I think that's when you published your first book on
Yeah,
Salman
definitely.
Rushdie, who was in the midst of his, I guess, most controversial moment at that time. And of course, now, thankfully, is still alive, although with what one now calls life-changing injuries following the terrible attack that he suffered. He's become a different sort of public cultural figure over those 35 years. I wonder if you could think back to that book and what's your take on the big man now?
That first book on him was really an accident in a number of ways. I mean, I was very committed to Latin America and Latin American writers, and I was going to be working on that for my dissertation. I had a couple ideas for dissertations before I settled on the Salman Rushdie one, which was eventually to be published as a book, as you say. But I knew that if I were to throw my weight into or try to, focus on that I wouldn't be studying with Said. So I thought, what is going on right now that brings together my interests in anti-colonial thought, a diagnosis of imperialism that is literary in its nature, and is, something that would fall under the rubric of his specialization, which was modern British literature, right? So I thought, there is this phenomenon that I noticed at the time, the third world, literary celebrity. There was, Garcia Marquez, and there was Isabel Allende, and there was Carlos Fuentes, and then there was Salman Rushdie, and there was others. So I sat down to write a book about this cosmopolitan celebrity idea. In other words, the authentic spokesperson for the third world, who was trained in Western universities and knows the discourses and the manias, of the metropolitan
Well,
bookmark.
of course, Tim, I grew up knowing him as the man who came up with the expression naughty but nice.
Oh, there you go. Okay. Delectable, I think, is
He
another
was
one
an
of
advertising copywriter,
No,
as far as
Delectable,
I
I
was
think, one of the
concerned.
factors. Yeah.
Anyway,
So,
sorry, go ahead.
no, right. I said, well, why don't I begin? I'll write the first chapter on Rushdie. Well, that first chapter grew into a book. And it's weird when you publish a book on somebody like that who then becomes this international scandal and sensation because of the fatwa. Because people then just assume that you wrote it because it's a big news item. But I began it and was done with it, actually. It was at the publishers when the fatwa hit. And I pulled it back from the publishers and added a chapter because I was trying to address it. Yeah, I mean, Salman Rushdie is such a disappointment in many ways. I mean, I think he's a great writer, and I'm so happy to have been, sort of associated with him. He was invited to my dissertation defense, by the way.
With
So,
which would have had the British
yeah.
special branch accompanying him had he gone.
So. No, because no, that was before the
Oh,
fatwa.
before it all
Because,
happened. Oh, sorry,
yeah,
right.
because I was done basically with my dissertation, which became the book, but that it hadn't broken yet. So anyway, to write a book like that, then you go in, you read all of his journalism, and you kind of follow through his life itinerary. And he was such a terrific voice. In two very different ways in the journalism of Britain in those days. I mean, first of all, he was absolutely fearless in going after Margaret Thatcher. He said some of the most cutting things that are funny in undercutting what she was all about. But he also wrote about the immigrant communities, the black communities, as it's known in England, which includes people not only of African descent but of Asian descent, that were, stunning. They were terrific, just really bringing to life the particular kinds of difficulties that they were facing and the racism of the British mainstream and so on and so forth. And what was cool about him too is that he wasn't above going after, the kind of identity politics within the black community that was then in formation. And I like that. I like the fact, and then, these wonderful defenses of the politics of literature and not like, pulling back from or attempting to kind of aestheticize out of existence the political undercurrents of the literary, which he did in his wonderful essay on Outside the Whale. So, he was this terrific force and was throughout what a wonderful book, a travelogue called The Jaguar Smile on Nicaragua when it was very much under attack. He was brave enough to, like in the early 1980s, appear in public with Said on the Palestinian question, back a little bit before it became more acceptable to, support Palestinians. He was really something, and it's just so disheartening to see after his move from Britain to the United States and, writing op-eds for the New York Times, of all things, him associate an entire religion, the religion of Islam, with fascism and terrorism, and kind of generalizing on his personalization of the attacks on him, to draw conclusions which I think are kind of not only, unwarranted generalizations, but also, feeding the war frenzy. It's so unlike what he had done before that it's sad.
Well, I remember Edward Said being interviewed about Hitchens' turn, Christopher Hitchens' turn, away from the book they'd done together towards his inflammatory right-wing attitudes and deeply imperialistic ones. And at least it appeared to me in the interview as I heard it that Said didn't understand this, was obviously wounded by it. But in a sense, had given up on Hitchens. And there is something about what happened with both Rushdie and Hitchens in terms of being embraced by liberal Washington and New York and allowed to say things because of your accent that would be hard for US accented people to say. So before Hitchens turned so far to the right, he could get away with telling the truth about the Clintons and others and Kissinger, as I found could I when I lived in the US because of my voice. Oh, they're just the Brits, they're crazy, they get away with this stuff, they're different. Ha ha ha. You know
That
what I
is
mean?
a really interesting comment, about the voice and the accent that one has and what one can get away with. Have you ever written an essay about that? You really should. It's a wonderful idea.
No, I haven't. Well, perhaps because I realize that I'm not quite in the same league of influence or anything else as those two. But I think it is an interesting thing. And of course, Rushdie being extremely light-skinned, no doubt enables his insertion, not his fault, into this upper-crust cosmopolitan world of the international bourgeoisie. A friend of mine commissioned his book on The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, really?
And this was one of those things. I think it arose. He'd written a New Yorker piece, or no, I know what it was. I think this is what happened. They thought that he might have something to say, or somebody thought he might. Negotiating with him was almost impossible, not because of him, but because of the special branch. Because by that stage, he was really, constantly being protected. So there would be things like, you can ring this number at this hour on this day for 3 minutes and he'll answer. Right? And of course, this publisher, British Film Institute, had no money, really. But I think the deal was you can sell it to the New Yorker and you can keep all that money and it'll be what's in our book and we won't ask for anything. I think that's roughly what the deal was in the end.
Interesting. Well, it's one of the more revealing things that he wrote, I think. It's a wonderful
It is.
autobiographical, really,
Yeah,
piece.
and you've written about it somewhere. I can't remember where, but in one of your pieces.
I wrote about it. I can't remember either. I wrote a long monograph on him for Scribner's. So I think it was in there. It probably was in there.
Oh no, I haven't read that, so it couldn't have been there. I think it
It was in
was.
there. Okay, maybe I mentioned it somewhere else. I don't recall now.
This is what I think we call a senior moment. Or alternatively, it is about the incarnation of a long, not padded CV.
I would, so right, that's the spin I'd like to give it, right? It's obvious, so
It's
much. How could I possibly remember?
not a senior moment, it's a CV moment. Yeah.
It's funny, like over the course, now that, as one gets to advancing years, there's things that were so much a part of one's intellectual focus that one wrote about. For me, it's Afro-Latin music, where I really, I came of age in New York City, living in the Latin community on the Lower East Side, and I saw around me music being performed that so swept me away and captured my imagination that I just had to find out, like, where did this come from? How did this get created? But I'm just trying to, I don't want to get into this necessarily. I'm just trying to say that, you see something that you take it on in a research-oriented way. I co-translated and wrote an introduction to Alejo Carpentier's Music in Cuba, which taught me a lot. This had, he's such a great and well-known author, right? The inventor of magical realism, but he is nobody really knew about this side of his life, as being a radio producer and had his own radio show with surrealists in interwar Paris, and that he was an opera librettist, and that he played piano fantastically well, but he also wrote about music in Cuba. It's like a groundbreaking book, and so I thought this has to be translated, so I translated that. But then I got so into it that I wrote my own book, Secular Devotion, all about Afro-Latin music as a kind of counter secular religion to the peoples of the book, kind of anti-West within the West, that's been ferociously popular and has influenced every aspect of American popular culture. That's kind of an African inner soul, as it were, to American popular culture, according to my argument. And this now is something I did in the early 2000s, and I just haven't had time to return to it. I don't talk about it. I don't go back to it. It's just this big thing, that I did in the past, and now I'm on to other things. It's just so probably unwise, really, in a way, because people associate you with a certain kind of line of thinking. Oh, he does that, but I've never really wanted to be that. I wanted always to kind of move with what was preoccupying me at the time. Not though without there being a connecting thread. And I suppose in my case, the connecting thread is imperialism, right? The everyday culture of imperialism. Almost everything that I have to say, regardless of the topic, comes back to that.
And I actually meant to ask you about the music work and, your interventions into so-called world music and so on. So I'm glad you've raised it. I had a couple of questions left, if I may, and then after those, what I'd like, if that's all right as a way of concluding, is to turn to you and invite you to add anything you may wish to what we've discussed. It might be revisiting a theme or topic we've mentioned, or it might be something else. So, I wanted to ask you about Wars of Position as a book and as a concept. And my prefatory remark to this, if I may, is that I have all sorts of trouble with the use of war as a metaphor, whether it's Gramsci or anybody else, the culture wars, the science wars, and so on, because I worry. And this is an obvious remark, that this denatures the reality of armed conflict and the horror of it. And I found some of the work, and this is not a dig at you at all, but in the 90s, about the culture wars and the science wars to be really a case of inflated rhetoric from the sanctity of tenured humanities professors that absolutely didn't think about those questions of imperialism that are central to you. So I wondered if you could come back at my allergy to war metaphors, but also take us inside this terrific book, really a landmark that you produced. I guess it's going back a little way now, in which I think you dedicate to Said.
I do. I dedicated it to Said. It, in my own mind, corresponded in my own, way, my own smaller way, to my favorite book of his, which is The World, the Text, and the Critic, which, like my book, was an attempt to focus on the politics and culture of the university itself, this
That's also
institution.
his brief Foucauldian flirtation, isn't it? That one.
Well, I think he's already worked his way out of Foucault by then.
Has he?
That's
Okay.
what I argue in the biography. I think that he very clearly in especially the long chapter towards the end called Criticism Between Culture and System is it's a rather harsh farewell letter to Foucault that
Okay.
is now in.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah,
I think
so
it's too long since I read this. I've
you know,
mixed up
you might.
my histories.
Yeah, I mean, your qualms with using war in a title of a book of cultural studies probably is well taken. I didn't think of that when I was doing it, and I chose it simply because it is a well-known phrase from the work of Antonio Gramsci. So it would be something that people within the university probably had heard of. But it also, of course, has a deeper meaning in that the argument of many people who had discovered Antonio Gramsci, given the, I don't know, the politics of post-structuralism, which predominated in the university at that time, but also in figures that aren't necessarily associated with post-structuralist theory directly and who have other dimensions, people like Stuart Hall, for example, who had written very pointedly about Gramsci, that from their point of view, Gramsci was important as a Marxist thinker for having abandoned what Gramsci called the war of maneuver, which is a kind of militant armed rebellion against the powers that be, right? The figure of the storming of the Winter Palace, in the Soviet or the soon to be Soviet Union in revolutionary Russia. So that war of maneuver was counterposed to the war of position, and the war of position is about laying the groundwork at for some, transformation of society at some future date, to do so culturally, to kind of get one's mind right first. And so I was alluding to what I took to be, number one, the kind of evisceration of a certain militancy within Marxism that would be associated with political activism, claims upon the state, organizing political parties, trying to enter the existing bourgeois parties, the Democratic Party, Republican Party, whatever, to try to, do away with that notion that this is the only way to be effectively political, and instead to say that it can be done by, writing books and essays within the university, essentially, right? And so I was critiquing that, but I was also noticing that there was, and I think there still is, right, the general tendency on the cultural left in the academy to replace the politics of doing with the politics of being. And so, we develop a notion of combat breathing. Right, just the very fact that I exist, as a minority or as a gay person or as a woman, is somehow itself an affront, to the powers that be. So there's that turn to ontology and away from epistemology that is very much a part of the thought structures of the cultural left in the university that I was critiquing. Secondly, there was this idea that the state, any kind of state, is by its nature oppressive, and a very system of law and authority itself to be truly radical needs to be undermined. And I was trying to show that this kind of anarchist sublime, as I called it, was fundamentally conservative in its political, gestures. So with these ideas in hand, I was trying to, look at the very thing that I think a lot of people who were in the age of the culture wars were denying out in the public sphere, which is, like the think tanks and the journalists for mainstream publications were all denying that anything that was going on in the university really had any traction or any effect, that we were all kind of lost in theory. And I was trying to show in several concrete instances in the chapters of this book, In War as a Position, that that was far from the case, that the ideas of the seminar room had become mainstream and were being picked up by major films like The Matrix and, and others. That you couldn't pick up a theater program, in New York, an off-Broadway show, without seeing the very people that we were discussing in, our literature departments being adduced and discussed and explained. So, no, there was a fabulous popularization of what we were talking about in our. There was an enormous relevance, but the problem was that the relevance was not necessarily positive in the effects it was having on the way that people were thinking, and that we needed to kind of recalibrate. So, I don't know. Without reproducing the entire book, I won't go on. But I'm just trying to say that this was what was on my mind at the time, and I, it really was greeted well by the press. It was, the press that published it, the Columbia University Press, and the people on the, the editorial board there said, "Oh, this is going to be such a, it's going to really like make the world go boom," but I think that it certainly had its followers. It certainly had people who, engaged me. I was interviewed on the radio several times. It was it wasn't didn't go unnoticed, but it did go suppressed, I would say. It was there was a somewhat of a conspiracy of silence in some ways, because what it was saying was so counter to what people had gone to believe about themselves, right? I mean, it's really remarkable, but I don't know how it is for you. But I mean, for decades now, my graduate students do not feel that they're just entering the profession and learning forms of accreditation that they will allow them to become professors to teach and write scholarly books. They see themselves as activists involved in a revolution, and that this is what the claims of theory are to them. There's a direct connection in their mind between being politically active and studying forms of theory. A Spinozist Marxist take on, the past is something that to them, ipso facto, in a kind of Althusserian way, is theory praxis as one word. And that is remarkable, and it must be countered. It's something that simply is, it takes a lot of persuasion to address it in such a way that people are willing to listen to. But I think that that then as now, probably more than, needed to be met head on. And I thought that book tried to do that in some ways.
No, thank you very much. My last question, Prof. Tim, before handing over to you to conclude matters for us, is to ask you where you see things headed for the humanities. I know it's a very big question, but in many places, enrollments are down. Little liberal arts colleges have been closing for 15 years. The ruling class still wants its children to study the humanities as part of their parthenogenesis, their civilization, their civilizing, they're becoming young ladies and gentlemen, they're getting high and having sex, but then moving on to marriage or grad school or professional school or both. And so if one's university is dedicated to satisfying that parthenogenesis, the humanities trundle along. What's it like elsewhere, even at an elite public big university like yours, which is more complicated?
Yeah, I think I have a couple of things to say about that that are unlike one another. One of them is I do think that the humanities will limp along and that they will continue. And there's lots of reasons for that. But one of them is that there are a lot of people who understand that it's in the humanities classroom and seminar rooms that a lot of the thinking that finds its way into commercially viable mass culture, popular culture is generated. Okay, so one of the things that's happening, it's not just the defunding of the humanities, but it's also a strong stress being placed in the giving of awards and in the opening up of new lines and so on and so forth for that dimension of the humanities that involves the creative arts, right? So, like at my university, there's this thing called the Regents Professorship, which usually goes to scientists, like most other places. But when it goes to the humanities, it's every single time a novelist or a poet that gets it, not people who, like us, do critical work. So that's one thing that will keep it alive. The other thing is that there's no other realm of knowledge publicly that is critically engaged in a generalist sense, right? This interdisciplinary sense that you, as a cultural theorist, a cultural studies, pioneer, would be, more than conversant with, right? That this need for that is one that a lot of undergraduates understand, and they go and they talk to other people, and they vote with their feet. And despite all of the attempts to dissuade them, because the humanities are declining, not because people have given up on them, but because people are being threatened to enter them, and because the money is being artificially withdrawn from them. I mean, we in the College of Liberal Arts, we help subsidize other wings of the university through tuition dollars, right? We're generating money that we're not getting back because the administrators are actively opposed to that critical dimension of what it is we do. So I think that the humanities will limp along, but they're also, there's got to be a lot of flexibility and there's new openings made. I think that we're also living in a time when a lot of people who got their degrees or nearly finished their degrees in the humanities, the literary humanities, let's say, the cultural studies humanities, have gone and made careers for themselves in museums or as filmmakers, as curators, as people who write. Somehow supporting themselves by other means for publications like, Jacobin and N plus One and The Baffler and those kinds of intelligent platforms that are not academic platforms, right? New Left Review, Catalyst. I mean, there's a lot of them out there. And I think that we're seeing a radicalization of society, that a lot of people are drawing left conclusions, even polls of mainstream America show that, the positions on most of the key issues are far to the left of our Congress. And I just think that given this, in spite of the direct attack, the direct assault on the humanities, and the attempt to defund the humanities, that the humanities will live on, not just at Harvard and Princeton, but also at large research one public universities like my own. But it will not be the case, of course, that there'll be as many jobs, and it will be very, very tenuous and difficult for anybody who attempts to enter them. But I can just say, I mean, my students have in the last 10, 15, 20 years, they've all gotten jobs in academia, tenure track jobs, not necessarily at the best schools, but sometimes they're very good schools. So, I mean, it can happen. You can eke it out. You got to really want to, and you got to believe very much in it, and in yourself to get it.
I appreciate that, and I think it's true. One of the things that happens again and again and again is that governments and other entities want to see market-based norms in universities, except guess what? They don't like the results. They want people to study things that are immensely expensive to fund, like science and technology. They don't want them to study things that are cheap to fund, like the humanities.
Well put. That's just the kind of argument that should be made to legislators. Yeah, that's
So,
true.
as always with governments that of a neoliberal skein, they love markets, except markets kept getting it wrong, Tim. They keep getting it wrong. So we have to meddle because we need the state machinery to ensure that things are really competitive. And by competitive, we mean driven by consumer demand, except consumers are stupid and they get things wrong all the damn time.
Yeah, I
Mean,
know. I mean, it's so amazing that one could believe any longer in the idea that contemporary capitalism is favorable to free markets. Think of all the embargoes that prevent companies from doing any business with whoever's politically out of favor globally, right?
yeah, or not only that,
It's not a
take a look at the whole world of US pro sports where there is no capitalism. There's just
yeah.
socialism for billionaires over
Yeah,
and over again. There's no relegation, there's no jeopardy, there's no new entry for new starters, nothing.
right. I mean, it's old news. It's commonplace, really, I suppose. But it isn't something that everybody pays attention to, that the United States government is giving grants of $2-3 billion to artificial intelligence companies that are startups that already have hundreds of billions of dollars in their coffers. Well, why would, so, there's that, or the new Cold War, the war against China particularly, is one that is essentially an admission of defeat, that they got outcompeted, that if things were left to the market, China would push most industries in the United States, with some exceptions, into dire straits. So it can only be artificially maintained by government intervention. It's not a free market, of course. But anyway, this is old news.
This is like a typical old guy leftist, things have gone to hell in a handbasket. I said that I wanted us to conclude with some thoughts from you. Can you uplift us, Prof? Are there things that we need to think about that are positive in all this? Or do you want to drag us down even further than I just tried to do?
No, I'm a, I don't know, maybe it's a sickness, but I don't, I took a lot of solace from the words of, what am I talking about? The wonderful, I can't, it's so funny, I'm blanking on his name. I love him, but he recently died, the author of City of Quartz, Mike Davis.
Mike Davis.
Mike Davis said, there's no time to be depressed. There's no justification in drawing apocalyptic conclusions. We're the majority. We represent common sense. We represent the ideas that most people embrace. Now, there is a media monopoly, a corporate media monopoly that makes it difficult sometimes for us to communicate, but there are many now alternative sources that show that people are able to do so. They can succeed in doing so. We can exert pressure. So I think that there is a radicalization going on. I think that this is epochal. It's not just a little blip on the screen. This is something that is allowing people to make certain kinds of connections. One connection, obviously, is that capitalism is no longer supportable. The planet cannot survive with capitalism continuing. So people are eagerly looking for solutions to that and being driven to the left. Similarly, as awful, as horrendous as the Israeli siege of Gaza has been, it has totally changed forever the Zionist claim to victimhood and to moral high-mindedness and carrying on the legacies of never again, in the face of the genocide of the Shoah, right? So the world is changing. People are seeing things that they didn't see before. And I sense it. I sense it in my undergraduate classes. I sense it in my graduate seminars. The people that, I'm fortunate enough to be able to help enter the profession are people who just are teaching me all the time. And they're so active and they're so aware. That has of a reverberating, resonating effect across the culture. We deal in ideas, we deal in persuasion, we know how to write, we have access to the public. It's being used more and more. One of the great legacies that Said left us, I think, is that image of the public intellectual as humanist, right? And a lot of people have taken that up. A lot of people have run with it, not as successfully as he, but they're doing it. So, what could be more promising for the future than an out-of-work PhD, with a laptop and some justifiable theory, huh? I mean, I think that there's a lot of reasons to feel that now is a brilliant time for organizing. People breaking from the Democratic Party is beginning to happen, I hope. It's there as an inkling. So I don't want to like paint in rosy colors this horrible time, but there are also good things dialectically that come out of horrible times, and I'm seeing a lot of promise.
Professor Timothy Brennan, those are really inspirational words. Your work has been an inspiration to many of us for decades, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Cheers.